the challenge of Protestantism. David, you might close the door. The first was Scripture on two levels. First, what is Scripture? Secondly, is all revelation in Scripture? Secondly, of original sin, whether and to what extent it is some kind of removal of the capacities of nature itself so that man becomes incapable of cooperating with grace or resisting, or is it the loss of a life higher than man's natural life? Then, justification, the process of justification, friend pointing out that justification is not only God's grace, it is that, but also somehow man's contribution to the process. Then on the sacraments, we said there was, first of all, what are the sacraments, or what is a sacrament in general? Then the number of sacraments, and finally, the nature of all seven sacraments, with great stress on baptism and the Eucharist. And finally, the Mass. I think we were on the sacraments, am I right? The nature of a sacrament, as defined by Trent, was that it gives grace in virtue of its conferral. The technical term is ex opere operato, which term, by the way, was defined by Trent. How does that differ from at least the classic Reformation concept of sacrament, which I think we were discussing when time ran out? It differs basically in that all that it requires on the part of the recipient is no obstacle to the grace. For the grace itself flows in virtue of the sacrament. And thus, the classic evidence of Catholic teaching on the nature of any sacrament is baptism. That's the par excellence, that's the paradigm of sacramental effectiveness. Why? Because you have an infant who surely contributes nothing. Not even his head. You've got to even carry him to the font. He doesn't even put his head under the water. He does nothing. But while contributing nothing positively, he places no obstacle for the same reason, that he gives nothing. And as a consequence, the sacrament takes effect. Anyone who admits that infant baptism confers grace, he is teaching Catholic theology. Why? Because that's the test. So sacrament is therefore defined as some visible rite instituted by Christ which confers the grace signified, and it should always be added, in virtue of the rite itself. The rite confers the grace. God does not merely use this as an occasion. He does not merely stimulate faith, and then the faith gives or gets the grace. No, it is the sacrament. In terms of numbers, of course, Trent defined that there are seven sacraments. It further said what would need a lot of discussion, that these seven sacraments can be proved, can be shown to have been instituted by Christ from the history of the Church. There is therefore an immediate appeal to tradition. And studies have since been made over the centuries, volumes written on the historical beginnings of confirmation, of matrimony, of the priesthood, and the rest. At the same time, Trent recognizes, and this is of some consequence, it recognizes that while the sacraments were quod substantium, as it says, as far as the substance of the sacrament goes, instituted by Christ, nevertheless, the Church, so Trent declared, has a right to further specify how a sacrament is conferred, and that is giving the Church tremendous power. Now that quod substantium, the substance that Christ instituted, that can be variously defined, is much controverted, and even in Catholic theology, just what does that mean? How much did Christ institute of, say, the sacrament of confession? Now clearly, the varieties of confession, from public confession in the early Church to extremely private confession in modern times, is quite a change. and with the sacrament of matrimony. The church over the centuries has quite changed the conditions of contract. And one of the reasons, by the way, why the church, say, required the presence of a priest at a valid contract where a Catholic is concerned was to, you might say, ensure that Catholics would not abandon their faith. And behind, therefore, the Church's very strong legislation on mixed marriages is the Council of Trent. That's where the thing got started.
Yes, John? When you say the Church can determine how a sacrament can be conferred, I may not...
Within certain limits,
I may not confuse this with, say, some of the ideas that have come out of, say, the congregational creeds where this church will decide which way to do it, the next town will do it this way.
In other words, the essence of a sacrament as to its matter and form, to get technical, is, or it is believed to have been determined by Christ. Therefore, in the Eucharist, it would have to be the elements of bread and wine and the words of institution, this is my body, this is my blood. In confession, there would have to be some communication of guilt, some manifestation of guilt on the part of the sinner, and then the corresponding declaration on the part of the priest.
But when you use the word church, it's not say a certain parish.
No, it would have to be, in fact, it would have to be the church under papal direction. Now, to illustrate a major declaration on the subject as regarding the sacrament of orders, of ordination. For years, it had been controverted as to what precisely constitutes the matter. Now, matter means, I don't know if we've touched this anywhere, the matter is the what of a sacrament. What do you use? The form is the how of a sacrament. In baptism, the matter would be the water, the how would be the words. Well, in ordination, among the controverted areas regarding the matter of the sacrament of ordination was whether or not the young neophyte being ordained, whether he would have to touch the sacred vessels. And it has been for centuries practiced by the church in the Roman Rite. Now, what difference did it make? Well, it made a lot of difference because it, first of all, created a lot of problems. If that was essential to the sacrament of ordination, and the man did not touch the sacred vessels, he wouldn't be ordained, if that's essential. Then the question of whether it was essential, because not all parts of Catholic Christianity had always used that as part of ordination. And the question of validity came up, especially among the Orthodox. Anyhow, Pius XII declared, it is not of the essence of the sacrament. And while the rite is continued, has remained unchanged, yet it is now known that, and the Church, a Catholic believes, has a right to declare what belongs to the essence of a sacrament. So in baptism, remember how I've been asking our various ministers regarding how they perform the ritual. Because as a Catholic, I know that part of the essence, so the Church has taught, Catholic Church, part of the essence of the form, they'll call it matter if you wish, or the form, of the rite is the pouring of water. The more accurate to be the matter. It is water being poured, not just water. You just have don't have a man or a child in water and somehow bring the two together. The water must be poured somehow upon the head of the person. If that has been declared by the Church to be essential, I as a Catholic believe that's essential. And therefore if somebody doesn't do that, I, as a Catholic, believe that's not a valid baptism, which makes a slight difference. See?
Yet you would say accept the baptism of a Protestant.
Yes, provided that is done.
Well, let's say it's someone that was, say, baptized in the Haven Reformed Church.
And I would ask, how was he baptized in the Haven Reformed? And I was pleased to say, was it Buis who told us, or forget which one, that he got his hands real wet and that the water actually flowed into the eyes. See? Okay, well, that's fine. Then you've got flow. But suppose he just, sprinkled in the sense didn't want to get himself too wet or wanted to spare the child getting drenched. See? In other words, I as a Catholic believe the child has got to be drenched with that water. Drenched sufficiently to have the water flow. And if he is too careful, he just gets his hand wet, puts it on the head of what I've found are sometimes very hairy children. Do you know that babies have a lot of hair? I never knew that until I baptized a couple. And they need a haircut. If he should, you know, in his kindness, you know, get his hand wet and put it on the head of the child with all that tuft on top, that child is not baptized, that's all. To my judgment, see? So, that was spelled out. Now, the number of the sacraments having been instituted by Christ. And finally, the nature of the sacraments. And this is a whole theology. Read briefly what your author has. He has some of the main declarations or definitions on the subject. We won't go into it. But among the sacraments which Catholicism has in common with Protestantism, the two sacraments that we should say at least a word about as far as their nature goes, namely baptism and the Eucharist, do bear some emphasis. As far as baptism goes, Trent declared, not only is baptism conferred on the child, unbeknown to the child, but what does it do? It removes that child's sin and confers upon it the grace of God. That divine life, which no one receives until the age of reason except through baptism, is conferred through the baptism. Then in terms of the Eucharist, at very great length, the Church defined, explicitly said, Christ is really, truly, and substantially present under the species, the elements, that is, of bread and wine. The word species is simply the Latin word for appearances. The appearances remain, the substance is no longer bread and wine. And the definition was on two levels, really on three, but at least on two. So the Eucharist is really present, Christ is really present, first as against the Calvinist teaching that it was a purely spiritual presence, and against the Zwinglian teaching that it was a purely symbolic presence. Here you have reality, and here you have truly and substantially. The substance, that which makes Christ what he is present there. And Trent further went on to say, and in one very crisp phrase of two words said, and thereby defined the Catholic position, after the words of institution are pronounced, Christ is present there as the totus Christus, the whole Christ. All that makes him what he is there, appearances to the contrary, notwithstanding. Finally, on the subject of the Mass, Trent went on first to explain the priesthood as a sacrificing priesthood and not merely a teaching or preaching priesthood. As you know, the word itself had been changed, even though it had been retained in some parts of the Protestant confessions of faith, I mean the word priest, it had quite radically changed from a sacrificing priesthood to a preaching ministry. And consequently, along with the word was the sacrament. And the sacrament here meant nothing less than the transmuting or changing of the elements of bread and wine into Christ's own body and blood, and then in the name of Christ offering, re-offering, if you will, that body and blood to the Heavenly Father. So there was a true sacrifice. Mike?
If Christ is there in total, what if there are several masses going on?
Nevertheless, he is equally present wherever the masses are said.
He's totally at any Mass.
Totally in every Mass and totally in every Mass. And the word substantially, by the way, means more than semantically it seems to imply. It declares both what and how. Pardon me, I thought something else. It is present there. Christ is said to be present there substantially, and therefore the substance of Christ is there, and not somehow the spirit or virtue or grace from Christ, that too, but he is there, not merely something from him, but also as far as the how goes. And this will answer your question, Mike. The way in which, if a person were to ask, how is the substance present in, say, anything which we have, say, in our own bodies? Where can I say that the substance of that which makes my body what it is, how is it present? Well, it's present, first of all, I don't see the substance. All I see is the physical properties of that substance. And wherever the thing is, there is its substance. It permeates all of me. And as far as substance go, I don't distinguish between, say, one part of me and the other part. It's the whole of my substance as substance of me is present wherever I am, whether my little finger or throughout my body. And I can't say that the substance of me making me what I am, or you what you are, is any more or less the top of my head than the sole of my feet. It is wholly and completely present in every part of me. It's me, it's I. So, the adverb substantially describes the mode, as we say, the mode of Christ's presence. See? Therefore, wherever the species are, wherever the elements are, there he is present, whole and entire. I break the species, he's present in both parts. I break them again, he's still present. See? I multiply those elements, he's present wherever they are. In a way similar to, analogous to, the way in which the substance of anything is present, in or to that which is its substance. Now, in the Mass, let's finish this, Mike. In the Mass, one thing which Trent went at to great lengths to point out was not merely what the Mass is, but what is its purpose, its function. And the watchword, the one word which was most challenged by the Reformers, and as a consequence, most clarified and expanded by Trent, was that it is a propitiatory sacrifice. It propitiates for sin. It expiates sin. This was Calvin's great scandal when he talked about the Mass. This, to him, was what derogated, so he said, from Calvary. How can you possibly believe in Paul's letter to the Hebrews, speaking of our having only one sacrifice, one priest, one cross, remissive of the guilt of all mankind, and yet, in any intelligible sense, speak of masses as being sacrifices? Well, Trent went on to explain that this propitiation is the application of those merits of Christ. Christ's sacrifice on the cross does indeed remit the sins of all mankind, but it remits that sin causally, genetically, basically, meritoriously, all kinds of adverbs that are found throughout the definitions of Trent. But when it comes to the use, to the application, to the specification, to the implementation, to the profiting from, of that which was gained on the cross, then you have the Mass, in which Christ offers himself. You don't even have to say re-offers, because he, as the eternal high priest, just continues always offering. Yet he has tied in to that double consecration, separate for the body, separate for the blood, to symbolize the separation of his body and blood on the cross. He has tied in not the gaining of merit, not to, as it were, re-redeeming the world, but to channeling, communicating giving those things which he had gained for the world on the cross. Without the cross, the Mass is an empty ritual. With the cross, it communicates that which Christ had gained for the world by dying for it. Now this, there are just pages and pages of Trent in spelling out in crisp theological terms, always being aware of safeguarding two things. On the one hand, the unique sacrificial character of the cross. On the other hand, the reality of the Mass. The Mass is not a bare memorial. It isn't just that it stimulates my faith. It makes me more conscious or aware or subjectively alert to Christ's death. It somehow communicates, transmits what Christ gained for the world by his death on the cross. And in that sense, it propitiates for sin. Now, John, you have a question.
I think this question is too naive.
From one viewpoint, the Eucharist, the moment the priest pronounces the words, "This is my body," at that moment, a Catholic believes the element of bread ceases to be bread as far as substance goes. Christ becomes present there, whole and entire, body and blood. Yet the priest goes on to another consecration. Now it's that other consecration which makes it the Mass.
The one can be...
Christ is already present before the second consecration.
One could have the Eucharist without the Mass?
Well,
practice?
In practice, no. In practice, no. And a priest is forbidden, absolutely forbidden, to ever consecrate one element without the other. No, in practice, no. But as far as effecting the real presence, yes. Yes. And consequently, the real presence is there, and the sacrament is there. Christ is wholly present under each element. And communion for a Catholic, as you know, is received only under one form, because Christ is wholly present. But a Catholic asks, as Trent asks, why did Christ consecrate both elements? Why didn't he stop? If he wanted only his real presence, once he said, "This is my body," since it is a living body, it cannot be without its blood, he didn't say, "This is my corpse. This is my body." Therefore, it's a living thing, a living entity. Yet he went on to continue with another consecration to symbolize, see, the separation that would take place on the cross. This is Jesus at the Last Supper. What would take place on the cross, namely the separation of his body and blood that caused his death. In the Last Supper, there was no death. In the Mass, there is no real death. Yet the real death, okay, is reenacted as to its essence. What is the essence of that which is reenacted? Now, did we go into this, the essence of sacrifice, in this class?
No.
In this class. The essence of sacrifice being the offering through one's will. Didn't we go into this?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that it is believed, therefore, that Christ being present there really, as a human being, can offer, or you might say just continues offering, from the cross on, in fact, from the Last Supper on. He continues offering what he consummated on the cross, namely, his willingness to die, should that be either possible or necessary. It is neither possible because he is not mortal, nor necessary because the Heavenly Father accepted his one real death on the cross as sufficiently remissive of the guilt of mankind.
Then a statement I read yesterday, is this a valid one? The priesthood is associated very closely, of course, with Mass. This is a Protestant remark that, in effect, what the Catholics have done is carried over the Levitical priesthood from the Old Testament to the New. Is this a caricature?
Well, the Levitical priesthood, but they've done more than that.
In the effect, they have. This is the way it was.
Well, what they have communicated is what they believe Christ continued, the essence of sacrifice, which is the essence of priesthood. In other words, in any language, any religion, you name it, Hinduism, Buddhism, right, the word equivalent to a priest is always a term equivalent to one who offers a sacrifice. And the only way in which you can eliminate sacrifice is to eliminate priesthood. So I would say yes, but it wouldn't be In other words, what had happened, just as say with the rite of circumcision, a vastly new meaning was added to it. And Catholics will appeal, say, to the prophecy in the prophet Malachi, or Malachiah, where he speaks of, in my name, a clean oblation, a clean sacrifice will be offered. From the rising of the sun to the setting thereof, and my name will be sacrificed, or be sanctified among all nations, among the Gentiles. It is therefore no longer the bloody kind of a sacrifice that the Jews offered, but there is a sacrifice.
Is Christ then, Father, repeating his sacrifice? And if he is, why the repetitive nature of it? Why not just the one time?
Well, it need not be said to be numerically repetitive. If you, by that you mean that Christ, as it were,
keeps offering
it over and over again. No, not in that numerically repetitive sense. It is, however, repetitive from our viewpoint. Okay? In that every time that we reenact what he, a Catholic, believes, we're told to reenact, he who is the eternal high priest, constantly offering, as Paul says, constantly interpolating with the Father, constantly pleading with the Father for the redemption of mankind. See, why should Paul say that? Why should he use the word like eternal high priest? Why say that he constantly begs for us? See? What does that constancy mean? Well, it means that we are constantly in need of redemption. So he is, you might say, his very presence in heaven. And we don't know just what he does. See? We can safely say that he's keeping no counter, you might say, on where's a mass going on? I'll have to repeat a mass. No. But he, in his role of mediator, and the only mediator with the Heavenly Father, has, so we believe, said that the effects of my sacrifice on the cross will be felt, will be drawn upon, whenever they repeat what I have tied in, see, the effectiveness of my one sacrifice to, and that would be basically the Mass. Now this, well, they're just, by the way, just to illustrate how much theology is locked behind this and hidden behind it. About 2 years ago, I happened to assemble a bibliography on the Eucharist and the Mass in English for colleges, for Catholic colleges. And it was an annotated bibliography, which I have some copies if anybody would be interested. I shouldn't have said that. I have only a few. But it amounts to 96 current volumes in print in English on this single subject. So you just have an idea, and some of them are multiple volumes. The great work by Jungmann, for example. It just did two volumes, I think it sells for $25 for the two volumes, which the Waldo Library very generously bought. The point is that there's just so much behind it, but basically that would be it. It was the one eternal volitional act which Christ ties in as to effectiveness through the repetition of that which the human priest does. Now there are four other items on Catholicism which I commend to your reading. I will just say a sentence or two about each and will not analyze. You have the text of the Immaculate Conception definition. All I wish to say there is that it was not occasioned by any controversy. It was, and this is interesting to note, partly, very, very partly, the fulfillment of a promise by Pius IX. Did you know about this? Pius IX was an epileptic. And he went through his studies, he had difficulties, he was a very intelligent man, went through his studies, but he was not ordained a priest because of his epileptic condition. Finally, after waiting, and this is quite some time, the whole process, years of negotiation and so on, finally, he was told the attacks had stopped, the seizures had stopped for, I think, 2 or 3 years. Yet he had them, and of course they were typically bad when they came. He was finally ordained on condition that he would never say Mass except with another priest always with him. In the meantime, he had prayed, as a good Catholic, to the Virgin Mary asking for being cured of his epilepsy. And, well, he managed, first of all, to get himself that 2 or more years of no seizures, and finally getting himself ordained even with that very difficult condition. And after his ordination, he never had another seizure. Well, it's a lot of things happened after his ordination, including his becoming Pope. And then, among other things, he did a great deal, Catholics would know, to promote the devotion to the Virgin Mary. The crowning achievement of his life, he said, in gratitude, was to define the Immaculate Conception. But theologically, the Immaculate Conception is a statement which is perfectly consistent with the Council of Trent. It says, in effect, that Mary, uniquely among pure creatures, Christ, of course, was both God and man, uniquely among pure creatures, was conceived, meaning that before she was born, she was without the stain of original sin, meaning what? She was justified from the moment of her first existence. So put positively, Mary is believed to have been justified from the first moment of her existence. Why? Because, so Trent said, her dignity as the Mother of God, in anticipation of her bearing in her womb nothing less than the divine essence, she was sanctified from the first moment of conception and therefore had never either contracted original sin or had committed personal sin. Mike?
Brother, can there be a secular pope?
Can there be a secular pope? What do you mean?
The man was not ordained.
Yes, he can be elected pope. Can he exercise the fullness of his papal power? No. He can have authority, however, even before becoming, say, ordained as a priest. Because we distinguish, or the Catholic Church distinguishes, within the papacy, as within anyone who has authority in the Church, the authority as such, the jurisdiction in what is called orders. See? And thus, for example, there have been lay, and incidentally, Pius IX had a layman who was his Secretary of State. Did you know that? Antonelli, which was perhaps not the wisest choice. The answer is yes, Mike.
Can you offer Mass?
No, of course not. Nor could he exercise the fullness of his episcopal or of his papal power. For example, he couldn't clearly consecrate bishops. And even as far as teaching goes, he could not, so it is believed, exercise the fullness of his authority in teaching unless he had the priesthood and the episcopate.
Is there anything that he cannot do if he is not ordained that cannot be done by someone else? I mean, you say he can't ordain bishops. Well, bishops could be ordained by someone else. But is there something that only the Pope alone can do?
Yes. He would not enjoy the primacy, for the simple reason that he would not be Bishop of Rome. Since to be Bishop of Rome, he must first of all be a priest. In other words, as far as just the bare exercise of authority, see, in the sense of telling people where to go or where to get off or however you want to put it, in terms of sheer obedience, see, he can exercise that without being a priest or a bishop.
Then how could you say that, he wouldn't have any direct historical lineage with Christ then, not being bishop, is that right?
Yes, well, that's precisely the point. In other words, there's a distinction. He wouldn't really be Pope in the full sense of the word.
So he couldn't make any binding statements of faith.
Right. That is believed to be tied in with the episcopal power which comes from Christ through ordination. But could he be Pope? Then, of course, you have to put Pope in quotation marks. The answer is yes. He could be elected validly as Pope and could exercise some kind of jurisdiction. But we're getting into subtleties. He would not be Pope in the accepted sense of the word because he wouldn't be Bishop of Rome. The First Vatican Council, there are things in your author that I commend to your reading. The big thing which the First Vatican Council defined, of course, was both the primacy and especially papal infallibility. Did it add anything to what had been taught before? Substantially, no. What did it say? It did say that in the exercise of his supreme teaching authority, the Pope is not subject to the bishops. And after all is said and done, that is the main issue behind papal infallibility. Because infallibility in the Catholic Church had never been questioned. The whole question was, who's got it? Who's infallible? Once you have a doctrinal society, you've got to have infallibility. Otherwise, a person can come along and say, Jesus is not God. Oh, is that so? That's right, he is not God. How do you know? I read it in the scriptures. Where? The Father is greater than I. Well, all right, now you've got a question. Is he God or isn't he? Somebody has got to decide. So there was never any question of whether there must be somebody to decide on such crucial questions. The whole problem was, who does the deciding? And the issue for 600 years in the Catholic Church had been whether it's the bishops along with the Pope, or whether it's the Pope, not quite minus the bishops. And this is where problems can arise, where the Second Vatican Council is out to clarify and to make sure the bishops won't feel hurt and won't think they don't have a lot to say in the Church. It isn't as though the Pope acts independently of the bishops, but that he does not need their approval. Nevertheless, it is believed the bishops will always, not because they just want to, you might say, play politics with the Pope, but the Holy Spirit will always protect the Church so that it won't be just the Pope as a complete isolationist teaching something. It is the Pope as, you might say, head of the Church along with the bishops. But in a showdown, it is the Pope who declares that something is true. The bishops may help him. They may give him insights. He will call a council to, you might see, instruct the Pope. But it isn't the bishops who decide on the infallibility. It is he. That was the issue. Dave?
Kind of a ridiculous question, I'm afraid. Once the Pope is elected, is there any possible way of removing him?
Yes. By his removing himself. In other words, if the Pope, assuming that he was validly elected, that would be a condition, assuming that he's validly elected, then there is no way in which there is no power as unless, I suppose he would say lose his mind, which is possible. Suppose he became mentally incapacitated. Well, then he would really cease to exercise, you might say, cease to be able to exercise his power, and you might say then there is really no longer one who must be in the possession of his faculties to be Pope. There is a kind of
judgment.
Please?
Who makes that judgment?
Well, that would be the question.
I mean, you have the same thing here. We have the President of the United States. Who says what he's not capable?
Well, it would not be, which is what you want me to answer, see, it would not be the council or the bishops. And this is the scandal of the papacy. Does that help? That's it. Then the assumption, which was defined in 1950, I happened to be in Rome at the time, some 700,000 people gathered in Rome for the occasion, the definition of the assumption. November the 1st, 1950. Now there, of course, it's the second stage, you might say, beyond the Immaculate Conception, defined in 1854, that Mary is in heaven, not only in spirit, as all the saints are, but also in body. Again, there is no controversy which occasioned the definition. What occasioned the definition, I would say, is both a growing realization, you might say, of the full implications of Mariology, which creates huge problems in the ecumenical movement, and also, and this is significant, Pius XII, who made the definition, said the morning after the definition, one of the main reasons why he defined the assumption of Mary as being in heaven, both in body and in spirit, was to meet the challenge of materialism. In other words, with a preoccupation with things material, with the materiality, and then especially, he said, with a preoccupation with the human body. That the human body is not merely something that can be used as a chattel. It is not something which can be exploited, say, by the ruling classes. It is not something which is just made for man's pleasure on earth. It is made for man's eternal enjoyment in heaven, but at the cost of controlling that body. In other words, to raise the faith of Christians to realization by properly using that body on earth, they will enjoy, and more than enjoy, in their body what most people want to jump the gun on and squeeze every last drop of bodily pleasure in this life. In other words, it was a kind of a caution. Wait, be patient, control yourselves. You get all the joy and body you're looking for and more, because you're going to have your bodies for all eternity, suffused, as he said, with the torrents of God's pleasure. Finally, in the same year, 1950, there was a document in which you have at great length in your book called Humani Generis. Humani Generis was a document issued by Pius XII to meet certain errors, whether already existing and being somewhere taught, or at least tendencies to those errors within the Catholic Church. And by actual count, there are 26 distinct areas of erroneous either tendencies or doctrines. I commend that to your reading, and it is an exercise. The Pope, by issuing that document, was an exercise of the highest authority, short of a definition, to warn Catholics, especially Catholic theologians and philosophers, not to compromise with the faith because of the prevalent erroneous philosophies. In philosophy, mainly existentialism. And in theology, mainly rationalism. And having handled theology and knowing what goes on, I can assure you those declarations, and call them condemnations, were called for. In other words, to clarify and to point out, take for example a very simple thing, like whether or not God had to raise man to the supernatural order. Well, what difference does it make? It's all the difference in the world. Because if God had to raise man to the supernatural order, you deny the nature of grace. Or, for example, somehow obfuscating the difference between matter and spirit. That somehow the one is or can become the other. And, for your information, among the writers who had obscured the distinction between matter and spirit was Desjardins. In his Phenomenon of Man, who was a Jesuit, as you may know, whose book had an introduction written by no less a worthy than Huxley, Desjardins obscured the distinction between matter and spirit. And his evolutionary process, therefore, makes it hard to show or see how God had to somehow enter into, no matter what evolutionary process you admit, that matter does not just become spirit by its own intrinsic powers. Mary?
Could you give just a very brief background in existentialism, Father? Just so we can... I know.
Very brief background. But suppose we... Shall we save it? We'll take a summary of the problem. And have you read, in the confession, I asked you to read it, how this thing is spelled out. What had happened was that a predecessor of the patriarch, Dositheus or Dositheus, by the name of Cyril Lucaris, he became first patriarch of Alexandria, and later on of the mother church of the East, which was Constantinople, in 1621, which by the way happens to be contemporaneous with Bellarmine, which puts him an even 100 years after the beginnings of the Reformation. Cyril Lucaris was a Calvinist, unabashed, unmitigated Calvinist. What he did was to, during his lifetime, which was quite long, quite revise the Orthodox creeds, especially his own creed, along Calvinist lines. 50 years, roughly, after Lucaris became the head of Constantinople, by the way, in the meantime, he had been murdered, and partly because of his machinations, he had got in trouble with the then reigning Turkish monarch. But in 50 years, it was felt the Orthodox creed had become so Protestantized that no less a person than another patriarch had the right to clarify that faith and say what is true orthodoxy. He himself was Patriarch of Jerusalem, which is, you see, one of the four main patriarchates of the Eastern original church, Antioch, Alexandria, Jerusalem, and Constantinople. And every one of the decrees, and there's a whole sequence of them, see, takes one after the other a basic principle of classic Reformation in terms much more forthright, much less mild, completely intransigent, right? Declares what we Orthodox believe and what we do not believe, as some, by whom we always meant Lucaris and his followers, have brought into the Orthodox Church. Let me just read a few so that you know where the high points are, and we'll go on to the Declaration of Arnhem. Decree 2. He is an insistence on there being two sources of revelation, scripture and tradition. Where tradition is, by Dositheus, identified with the church. And this, of course, is typical Orthodox teaching. That's Decree 2. Then in Decree 3, and that's the crucial one, in Decree 3, let's even read it. We believe the most good God to have from eternity predestinated unto glory those whom he hath chosen, and who have consigned unto condemnation those whom he hath rejected. But not so that he would justify the one and consign and condemn the other without cause. That phrase, without cause, that's the crux. See? In other words, he is against absolute predestination. And what is the cause? The cause would be man's failure to cooperate with grace. Some perversity on the part of man, for which he, man, is responsible. 490. And this, Decree 6, I mentioned in the other class, and it's just too bad, the only limitation, the only problem with the summer school teaching is shortness of time. Just can't stretch your elbows. But it is valuable to see the Reformation through Orthodox eyes. See? This, at least, is what they thought the Reformation meant. Now, among the things they felt the Reformers were teaching was a denial of the distinction between actual and original sin. Or, as I said in my last class, original and personal sin. Dositheus felt, going into the writings, dipping say to the writings of Calvin, that if you've got a nature which is completely depraved, all of whose actions in the moral order are sin, and if, ex hypothesi, that human nature is without the capacity for resistance to God, for cooperation with his grace, then what is sin? There is only one kind of sin. Very simple. It is human nature in its operation. Sin is fallen human interacting. Because you see, behind the concept of actual sin, of personal sin, is a premise. The premise is that I can here and now deviate from God's will. It isn't just my nature operating, it is me as a person, as an individual operating. Am I deviating from God's will? But it presumes that I've got a will with which to deviate. Anyhow, Lucaris felt, pardon me, not Lucaris, Dositius felt that in Decree 6 there is actual sin, and not only original sin in its operation. In other words, actual sin is not merely original sin in its manifestations. See? Just as good works are not merely grace in God's grace in its operations. It is grace plus God's will cooperating. And sin is man's nature resisting God's grace. Then in Decree 6, and very typically, and I've got a great big circle around all being on top of 491. So, first, the decree says, surely there's only one mediator between God and man, the only mediator. He is the one through whose ransom the world was redeemed. Albeit, in prayers and supplications unto him, we say the saints are intercessors. And above all, and this is typical, by the way, of Orthodox teaching, a great devotion to Mary, much more so than among the Roman Catholics. At least, I am told, this is on Orthodox authority, that there is a feast day of Mary for every day of the year. Which is a lot of feasts. Anyhow, the fact that there is such a thing as intercession of saints, including Mary, which they felt, you see, was challenged by the Reformation. That's in Decree number 8. Then, in Decree 10, in the second full paragraph in 492, while again admitting that Christ is the great high priest, nevertheless, there are along with him real priests. Real priests. And there I should just like to insert a word, because if you can just parallel the two, the corresponding insistence on man's autonomy, and therefore his capacity for either cooperating with or rejecting grace, can be transferred to the social order. That while Christ is indeed the one supreme mediator between God and man, nevertheless, socially speaking, as members of a society, just as we individually cooperate for our salvation, so we need the help of others less than Christ. Because it's not just a lineal relationship, God, Christ, me, but me as part of a body, me as part of a society. And that they, therefore, others who are members of the society, can help me, and I, of course, can. Then, Decree 13, an insistence upon good works along with faith. We believe a man to be not simply justified through faith alone, but through faith which worketh through love, that is to say, through faith in good works. So in other words, it's not merely that I believe, but that having believed, I must somehow live out that faith. And I can, if I wish, believe without being good. Decree 14 corresponds and spells out in great length the fact that man's nature is not totally depraved. And a crucial sentence occurs somewhere just above the middle of page 497. So as to be by nature able to choose and do what is good and to avoid and hate what is evil. But the value of a document like this is at least to see that this is the Reformation seen through Orthodox eyes. Namely, the concern for saving man's intrinsically good nature, although fallen. Then Decree 15, he insists on there being seven sacraments. Neither less nor more. And then they go on through all seven. including, of course, Eucharist as both sacrament and sacrifice.
Isn't this then just Catholicism without the Pope?
Well, that's what some would say. That's all I pulled out. Those are the essentials. I'd say, yes, Mike, except there is a big difference, however, when you come to the concept of authority in the Eastern Church, which is a little more than just Catholicism without the Pope, because there are so many things that have entered Orthodox teaching through their belief in the Church as Church, you see, being vested with, call it infallibility or the primacy, and that consequently, they have almost no development of theology from the 8th century. So I would say it is 8th century Catholicism without the Pope, yes, Mike. Okay, much more than 8th century Catholicism, see? They've recognized, if you know, only the first 7 councils, and therefore that would be 14 less than Catholicism has, including the Council of Trent. But this corresponds, by the way, you'll notice, roughly to the Council of Trent from the Orthodox side, hence the value of this confession method. Now the Bauman Declaration. First, how come? The immediate occasion for the Bauman Declaration was National Socialism in Germany. It had by this time, 1934, which is fairly early, because I think, did Hitler come into power in 33? Who knows? Was it 33? When he became Chancellor? Please? Well, he was in power, but when did he become actual Chancellor?
33.
I wasn't quite sure. The point is that by this time, National Socialism had become a threat to all Christianity, demanding complete allegiance, but notice this, allegiance on ideological grounds. See, National Socialism, as you know from any study you've done, was not only a political philosophy. It was in its own way a religion. And Rosenberg, for example, the great philosopher or theologian, if you wish, of National Socialism, made that pretty clear. There was a mythology behind it, in the technical sense of the word, of the unchallenged, unprovable things, mainly the superiority of the Aryan people and so on, and a real deification of the Führer, which made the nation a kind of theocracy in reverse. But secondly, that was the, you might say, the overall reason for the Bauman Declaration. The immediate reason was the compromise of not a few Protestants with National Socialism, where churches, pastorates, and theologians were, well, saying, it's not so bad after all. Now, no doubt they were under duress, under pressure. We don't know how sincere they were. Maybe they weren't, which perhaps would make it worse. At least he would explain what they did and what they wrote. And significantly, the National Socialists at first were quite friendly to the churches in order to win them on their side. And as a consequence, especially given authority which they had never enjoyed before, which helped them no end, at which point then Karl Barth and the Bauman Declaration in a way is Barth's confession of faith. What I will give you, I hope on Monday or Tuesday, is the statement of Barth regarding the Second Vatican Council. You will see how this stands out. This was not framed by Barth. I mean, but Barth stands behind it. It's his theology. The declaration is really more than just a declaration. It is, in its own way, I would say, a creed. It is a declaration of faith. There is a certain intransigence about it. In fact, there are anathemas, which are a little unusual in Protestant history, because each one ends up with a, we repudiate.
which would be a good equivalent for anathematize.
Now, the repudiation as such is the repudiation of those who had compromised. Notice. What was the purpose of it? Well, I have four purposes. First, it was to clarify what should Christians believe, and while they were immediately writing for the German churches, mostly in the evangelical tradition, nevertheless, they felt they were writing, in a sense, for all Christians. So to clarify. Why? Because there was confusion. On the part of whom? On the part of those who had compromised. Secondly, to protect. To protect the people from the wiles and insinuations of those who, through their confusion, would gradually wean people away, especially the leaders, church leaders, from allegiance to their faith. Thirdly, it was to inspire, to give them a sense of dedication, to give them a call, you might say, something to work in, even to fight for. And there was a militancy about this declaration, as you can sense in almost every line. And finally, it was meant as an answer, as a response to those who really were challenging the evangelical church, namely the compromisers. So to clarify, protect, inspire, and respond, so that on the last step, people wouldn't feel, well, we don't know the answers. We've got something which we stand by, and this is what we believe in. What are the features? There are three features that I have found in the Barman Declaration. I've used it regularly, I quote it. It is, to my mind, the most inspiring document of modern Protestantism. First, in what you might call the Reformed tradition, but frankly in the Christian tradition, it insists upon the sovereignty of God, not in the old Calvinist sense of, although Barth is a Calvinist, of denying, say, man's autonomy, which is the popular concept of God's sovereignty in the Calvinist tradition, but rather in terms of God's sovereignty over and above usurpation of authority by those less than God. Secondly, of dedication to Christ. It cuts through a lot of doctrine, a lot of theology. There's very little theology as such, as we will see. It rests the cause, and it, to my mind, it's the most, to me, one of the most satisfying.